Blog Talk Radio.
Tragedy turned triumph. It's David and Goliath. I made it to the eye of the storm, feeling torn like they fed me to the lions. Before my time starts to wind down like the Mayans, I show them how I got the grind down like a science. It sounds like I'm riding on hush. It's so quiet, the only thing I hear is my heart. I'm inspired by the challenge that I find myself standing eye to eye with. To move like a wise warrior and not a coward. You can't escape the history that you was meant to make. That's why the highest victory is what I'm meant to take. You came to celebrate, I came to celebrate. I hate losing, I refuse to make the same mistake.
Okay. Hello, Joseph. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Well, I am fine, sir, but I would like to know who I am talking with. Mrs. Black told me that I would be a guest on an important show with the title of Men of Honor. And so with that, I accepted to be on this program. Who am I speaking with?
Okay. My name is Earl Sewell. I'm an author. I'm a professor. And I have published 25 novels in various genres, from young adult fiction to historical fiction. Matter of fact, my most recent work of fiction is a work of historical fiction that takes place in Mississippi and Alabama between 1918 and 1951. Hello?
Oh. Now, let's back it up again, and if you could just tell me your name in slow motion, because I didn't get all of that, and I really want to be able to pronounce your name correctly.
Sure. So, once again, the name is Earl, and the last name is Sue.
Earl?
Earl. Duke of Earl. Yeah.
I like that.
Okay, cool.
And
so
the last name is what?
Sewell. Sewell.
Oh, Sewell.
Yes.
Oh, Mr. Earl Sewell.
That is correct.
Okay, all right. Do you mind really if I call you Earl?
No, not at all. We're very relaxed around here. You can call me Earl.
Okay. And you can call me Joseph.
All right, Joseph. My latest book is a work of historical fiction. And it takes place between two states, Alabama and Mississippi, between the years of 1918 and 1951. And so the book itself is inspired by ancestry work that I did on my father's side of the family. So I did a lot of historical research. Yes, I did a lot of historical research, searching for men of honor in my family, trying to piece together the missing link of the stories and how the men in my family and the women in my family as well survived during that particular period in America, in American history, which is, you know, one of the most shameful periods of America's history. And so so on this show, we're going to talk about men of honor and basically about being a father in this country and how we are as men taught to be good fathers, how we're taught to be good men, the lessons that we've learned, and the things that we pass along to others that are our children and even perhaps not our children, because as you know, there's an old African proverb that says it takes a village to raise a child. Would you agree with that?
I most certainly do. I really do. Actually, I am glad that you and I are having this conversation because having been involved in the civil rights movement as a part of the Tougaloo Nine college students staged the first sit-in in the all-white library there on March the 27th, which will be the 58th anniversary tomorrow on March the 27th. 1961, and it just dawned upon me is that since I was, we were a part of the second half of the Reconstruction period, breaking down the barriers of Jim Crow segregation, and finally we won our right really to being a part of the implementation of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, as well as the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And so it dawned upon me, Earl, well, you know, since we were part of the second half of the Reconstruction period, I want to know more about that particular period after the Civil War. And so now I'm deeply immersed into knowing more about that history after 1865, right on up to the compromise of 1877 when the Reconstruction period ended. And so listening to you really doing research on your ancestors and going back to that particular period of 1918, I think, that just lets me know, Earl, that I am really, really doing what I am supposed to do. Here's a brother that I'm talking with that has had the same motivation to the extent that he wanted to find out more about his ancestors. And my ancestors, my grandmother, who was a former slave from out of Belzoni, Mississippi, which was the Delta. And so it just seems as though now our passions and our research efforts are parallel to each other. So I am grateful for that bit of information that you shared with me. It just lets me know that my interest really has been validated by your research and your interests.
Yeah, and you know, I thank you for saying that, because, you know, again, I was looking into family and I was looking into stories. I was looking into, you know, how the men and women survived and what they passed along. Now, you know, in, you know, transparency, you know, there were good things that they passed along as far as knowledge and wisdom, and then there were some other things that, because of the era and time period, that just, you know, that, you know, some bad behaviors got passed along, you know, unintentionally,
right.
I believe. And so,
right.
So, you know, I'm going to start off with, you know, with an interesting question that, you know, that we can both chew on for a bit. And
right.
that question is in the African American community today, we see our young men, I see them. I'm 50 years old. I see our young men with their pants sagging, with lack of respect, and sometimes
mm-hmm.
generally just lost. For example, as a college professor, I have found myself mentoring young men because of the absence of another male figure. And I'm talking some very fundamental principles here that I think
mm-hmm.
that our young black men have been cheated on or cheated out of or lost or whatever the case might be. So I want to get your perspective as to why do you think that, you know, we are struggling, you know, to raise our young men, you know, to pull their pants up, to be respectful. You know, you don't have to cuss out a woman, or you don't have to put all that stuff in your music. What are your thoughts on some of that stuff as we try to give young men some guidance and some principles to sort of, you know, live by, especially those ones who are vulnerable and just don't see a way out of the situation? You know, we had our civil rights movement, and then we had, you know, that was supposed to change everything. But yet, still, here we are, still struggling in a way that we didn't think we would be.
Right. Well, Earl, I'm glad that you really are genuinely concerned about that aspect with regards to the behavior of our young men, especially in light of the progress that we have made since the advent of the civil rights movement. But the only problem that I always come back to is from the very beginning, this country has always been totally responsible from the very beginning, even though they do not want to admit it, neither do they want to discuss their part in breaking up our family, Earl, and that is what I'm analyzing, is that in spite of the progress that we have made with regards to voter registration and right on up to the first African-American president, that socialization of just taking away the breadwinner of the family and even those men that really had the knowledge and the knowing the importance of raising a family, any of those men from the very beginning of the government at that time, as you know, they eliminated those men that were really in a leadership position. And so somehow or another, with the absence of fathers, like we were blessed, and that's a capital B, that we were blessed to have, as far as the masses of those young people that we are talking about today, they did not have those fathers really who should have been socialized in teaching them the principles of respect. And so when you look at the masses of black men, basically a victim of this system of unjust laws, it, like you said, it takes a village to raise a child. But if you notice, most of those young men that we're talking about, for the most part, they were raised by their mothers. And then we go back to, in terms of my probation experience, Earl, I spent 30 years trying to do my best to educate the young black men that were incarcerated at Los Padrinos Juvenile Hall in Downey, California. And what I found out with regards to the living conditions and their socialization, which caused them to end up being classified as a juvenile delinquent, all came from the lack of having a father in the home. Most of those kids, in terms of when I met their mother, even those that I would release, very seldom would I have a father to come to the station to accept the release of their sons. It was always the mothers, and so therefore, that particular generation, in terms of their behavior and their culture, has taken on profound disrespect for the mothers and the men that, like our fathers, they don't want. It's a new generational shift. And that's basically where we are now, Earl, because I came from the juvenile justice side, and that caused me to have been involved once again in the civil rights movement in trying to explain to those youngsters who had just gotten into the system, showing them about the offenses, the alleged offenses, and how the juvenile justice system classifies them into the system as being delinquent. But almost every account. It was always the mothers in tears. It was always the mothers letting me know that they are doing the best that they can. But when the youngsters began to associate with those young men, basically, that is involved in that kind of culture and baggy pants and all of that, that's basically where it began, and it continued right on today. And so that's my experience with that kind of culture. We've lost, for the most part, that segment of the new generation.
You know, we have a commonality of experience here when it comes to, you know, juvenile delinquents and being in the yeah,
I know it. It's, like I said, I think this program really was a godsend. I call it divine intervention. Because, like I told you from the beginning, our experiences are parallel to each other. You're 51?
Yeah. Yeah, so I have done work
in
juvenile. I'm 50. 50.
50?
And I have
50?
50, yes. Yes.
Earl, I am 81.
And that is a beautiful thing. That is a beautiful thing.
And I come from up out of the Jim Crow South at the age of 30 to California. Primarily, I thought I was going to live in Los Angeles, but my wife's sister and her husband moved to Santa Ana in Orange County. And so I have lived and have had the experience for 30 years being in a totally segregated system, and then also having been out here in California, and I'm 81 now. And it isn't that I'm saying that I've seen everything, but I am well qualified to share my experiences with someone your age who is 50. My son is 59. He will be 60 years old this year, December 6th. And my daughter is 60, who will soon be 61 on October the 19th of this year.
Okay. All right. That's wonderful. Another interesting thing is that I have done work in juvenile detention centers. So I have volunteered my time to go into places that other writers would not go to sit and read with young men.
Wow.
And young women. And one of the things that struck me when I was in a juvenile detention center in Philadelphia, I took the time because when juveniles get detained, they still have to have some kind of schooling, and so I worked with the librarians that were in the prisons, and they were struggling to find novels that would engage this demographic, and so my novel spoke to this particular demographic, so I volunteered my time to go and talk to them. And, you know, spend time reading with them. And I tell you, every time I went, the young men and the young women, they all said, no one has ever sat down to spend the time to read to me or read with me. And it meant a great deal to them. And one particular young man that I'll never forget, he set up the book club inside the juvenile detention center. He was clearly a leader. Yes, he was clearly a leader, but he just did not have a good mentor to help guide him. But once he got taken out of what he was able to flourish, he was able to flourish a little bit better. So when I came in there, he had about 9 other guys, and he made them read the book. And so when we went in there, we had one of the best discussions, not only about the material in the book, but, you know, what does it take to be a writer? How do you tell story? And all of them had a story within them, and they were too afraid, or nobody encouraged them to write it.
Mm-hmm.
Because they didn't think it was worthy. So I was encouraging them that it is so worth it, because if you have gone through this, and if you can write something and, you know, put it out there on a blog post or something to help somebody else, you may prevent somebody, you know, through your experience from going down this road. And then the other thing is that the men in there said that I never thought I would actually enjoy sitting down and reading a book, because it wasn't a habit that was formed. You know, because, you know, reading helps with your critical thinking. It helps with your behavior. It helps with how you see the world.
It
does so many things. It does so many things for you. So the point is this, which was really interesting. One young man came up to me and says, hey, you know, I know that you have a bunch of books. You know, I want to read the next book in the series, and I get out next week. And he says, where can I get your books? I said, you can go to the local bookstore. You know what he said that really upset me, that I just hit me? He says, there's no bookstores in my neighborhood. And I said, well, go to your local library. You can find it at the local library. And here's what he said. The library is in the other gang's territory. I can't go over there. And I just you know, so I'm like, where did we break down, you know, or how do, not even where did we break down, how do we fix something like that? Here you have a person that could possibly spend time at the library as even a safe haven to just go and read, but he's so trapped in his mind that he couldn't think the library is in the other gang's community, so I can't go there, but he wasn't able to think, go to a different community.
Mm-hmm.
And it was
mm-hmm.
just fascinating that sort of thinking had not developed in him yet. But it was, I was like, oh my God, if I could just take you and just put you through a mentoring program to help you become a better man, it could change your life. So have you ever had any experiences like that in your lifetime where you saw the potential in someone and you tried to nurture them along?
Yes, Earl, but before I really get into that dialogue with you, I have an important question to ask you in terms of your status as a professor, as a writer, as an author of many books. Earl, what thoughts came to your mind to cause you to become motivated to visit a detention center? Because too many professionals out there that really are thinking about volunteering not only to visit the juvenile halls, let alone the prisons. So I want to know, motivated you to think enough about volunteering in an incarcerated setting like that with your status?
I wanted to make a difference. So there's a two-part thing to that answer to that question. The publisher that I was publishing publishing my book at the time was a publisher called Harlequin. You may know them. They generally write women's romantic fiction, you know, the Fabio on the cover. And so the president at the time was a forward thinker, and she wanted to tap into the young adult market, specifically for African-Americans and people of color. And she specifically asked if I would be willing to do it. And for me, I said, Absolutely, because as a child coming up in the 1980s, every time I would go to the library to try to find a contemporary book that reflected the life or the experience that I was, you know, going through, it just did not exist. Publishers did not publish those kinds of books because they didn't think that Black people, especially Black boys, would read fiction. They didn't see any money in it. They didn't see any money in it, so there was a zero sum game.
Right.
So when they said that, I said I can lead the charge for change. I said I believe the reason that you think that is because you know, businesses aren't opening up bookstores. Borders isn't going into the heart of Inglewood and Chicago. They're not going into the heart of Chicago's West Side, where there's, you know, high crime and high poverty. You know, they're not going there. So these people aren't, this particular demographic isn't even trained to say, okay, I want to go to a bookstore. But if I go into middle class America, you got bookstores with coffee shops and people are just hanging out and they're reading.
Well, there you go. You're not going to find that in Watts, you see, in Los Angeles. And it was not until I realized that until I began interviewing those youngsters from those neighborhoods. And that's where our understanding is very clear with regards to the environment that these youngsters really live in, and it's the same in whatever city you're in. If they are corralled to living in those communities. Now, when I moved to Orange County, you got everything here, you know, malls, bookstores, you name it. But in that particular section. In that particular section of Los Angeles, we're not talking about Hollywood, Bel Air, Beverly Hills. Well, see, you know what I mean? That interests me, and that's what you are just sharing with me is the same understanding of the socialization of these young people. But was that one of the reasons why you decided to volunteer to visit the juvenile hall?
Right, and I wanted them to see someone of color who was a man. I wanted them to see a man that was into literature, literacy, and writing, and to tell them the importance. I wanted to inspire, even though they were in a dark place right then or whatever.
Oh, wow.
I wanted to inspire to say, you know what, if anyone has ever told you that you're a bad writer or that you can't write or this or that, I told them I am living proof that, you know, I came up in a system where I was not a strong reader, I was not a strong writer, but I said I kept at it because there was something inside of me that said I had this story to tell, and I'm bringing it out. And I said, who knew that I, when with me sitting at my little desk at the, I mean my tape, sitting down at the kitchen table with a legal pad, writing this particular story out in the book form that you read, when I was writing this book 5 years ago, I had no idea that I would be sitting here talking to you and inspiring you in this particular moment to think about this. I told them, you have to understand that, you know, I come from a family and a culture where my grandfather, my father's father, you know, and my grandparents had 18 children together, 18, in Mississippi, you know, back at the turn of the century.
So you're connected to the Deep South.
Yes. And so I said, you know, although that generation, they were denied the privilege of holding a book and reading. They were denied it. And here you have the privilege of what the generations before you did not have. Take it. because you're in these walls, you're behind these bars, and you feel like you're a caged animal. Free your mind. Free it. So that you don't. And so those are the kinds of things that I was, trying to get through to those young men. And they were black and brown men, and they had chips on their shoulders, and they were angry and they were upset. And I said, beyond that anger, behind that anger is a wound. You're wounded, and you're covering it up with anger. I said,
Was this in Philadelphia?
This was in Philadelphia.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I've done them in Oakland. I've done them in Chicago. I've done them in Philly. I've done them in Atlanta. And I was, because I said I wanted to make a difference. I don't know if I wanted to touch and make a difference as a black man, because I don't want them to think that the only thing you see as a black man is he's shackled, or he's locked up, or he's
right.
super fly, or he's, I said, I'm not an anomaly. Anything is possible. Is it going to be easy? No. Are you going to have some trials and tribulations? Absolutely. Is it going to be a struggle? Absolutely. But, it is going to be well worth it if you stick with it. Nothing comes easy. Nothing.
Ooh,
matter of fact, nothing comes easy. You got to work. And, just like getting to jail wasn't – so anyway, I could go on about that. But anyway, so get back to your question of, have you ever had someone that you saw potential in and that you gave of your wisdom and your knowledge and your time?
Yes, first and foremost, I was ordained – as a minister at the age of 21 into the Disciple of Christ Church, which better known as the Christian Church. And having had that experience as being a part of the 209, as a matter of fact, they chose me the time I got to the campus of 209 Southern Christian College in the fall of 1960, Medgar Evers, who was the first black field secretary of the NAACP, he was one of the always featured speakers there at the Tougaloo College. And so I attended that night. Next thing I knew, I was chosen to be president of the NAACP Youth Council, which of course led to the read-in, so to speak, on March the 27th of 1961. Now, fast forward it to August the 28th of 1972 here in Los Angeles, Earl, that was the beginning of the acceleration of the gang movement, the Brims, the Crips, the Bloods, and I can't think of the others, but anyway, I became a probation trainee on August the 28th there at Los Padrinos. After having spent 2.5 years there in the juvenile hall, working with the youth, the police department and sheriffs were sending so many black and brown kids to Los Padrinos as a result of their biasness and their prejudices and the way they would label blacks and brown as gang members, even though there was no evidence of such. It's just that that particular community that they serviced every day, they just thought every black and every brown kid was a gangbanger, and no matter whether the alleged offense merited detention or not, they exercise their authority as law enforcement officers and saying, you're going to juvenile hall. And so,
I said that mentality goes back to chattel slavery, where they thought all the Africans that they picked up off the Ivory Coast were the same, but they were different people from different tribes with different cultures and different languages. You could not treat them all the same.
Exactly. And so when they posted a new program called the Intercept program, which was implemented in the January, I think, of 1996, I volunteered to become a part of that program. And I'm saying Intercept, well, what does that mean? And the probation director said that law enforcement is really creating an overcrowding situation there in the juvenile halls, and we need probation officers in those stations to screen the detention requests by the detectives. Well, Earl, my first assignment in the Intercept program was in Lakewood Sheriff Station, and I was on call to Downey PD, then Norwalk Sheriff Station, on call to Whittier PD, and then Pico Rivera Sheriff Station, on call to Huntington Park. Do you realize, Earl, I went into that job as a minister, not as a deputy probation officer, because the longer I stayed there in those stations, I saw that I had the opportunity, like you, to make a difference in the lives of those young people, black and brown, that they were being really incarcerated, not based upon whether the offense, alleged offense, really was the correct decision, but it was only because of racial prejudice and biases. And so when I was there, working with those kids, they would send youngsters up for me to interview. Do you know, Earl, I took out my legal pad. I had plenty of pens. And when I would review the youngsters' prior arrest history, and mostly men, mostly young men, then I would sit them down. When I would review their prior arrest history, Earl, For the most part, their arrest history was like based upon alleged receiving stolen property, being associated with someone who had just stolen a car. And I knew then that I had to do something about educating those youngsters that I knew they didn't have a clue with regards to how the criminal justice system worked. Do you know, Brother Earl, I explained to them that the only reason why they were detained, it was not because of the merit of the offense, which in most cases I would tell them, you could be released tonight. And they would surprise, really, really? I said, yes. But let me explain something to you, brother. I said, you see this offense on receiving known stolen property, you know what I mean, 496 Penal Code or GTA. I said, what causes you to be incarcerated is, young man, is not based upon your offense, but it is based on how many police contacts you have been involved in. And in your neighborhood, you're going to always have numerous police contacts, whether the offense is sustained in juvenile court or dismissed. And so, therefore, you have got to watch out for who you associate with, because that's going to increase your police contacts, which will cause you to continually to be detained. I would take from 5 to 20 minutes educating most of those kids that were salvageable. My colleagues, actually, they were surprised in terms of how much time I took interviewing some of those kids, and then they would pass by my office, and I had some of the kids in tears, only because they felt a personal connection with me, because no one had ever, like you, took the time to explain how the criminal justice system worked. And
the other,
and so with my colleagues, to them, it was just a job. In other words, you could interview a kid in 5 minutes or 10 minutes, but they still knew that they would get paid. With me, it was a ministry.
Right.
And that was my work there in that program. One case in point, it was a mother that came to Eagle River Sheriff Station. And I took my job in a responsible way. I knew that I had the authority, and that is what the sheriffs or the police officers did not like her, because I was the only black probation officer that had the authority to release a kid that they was bent on detaining until they went to juvenile court within a 72 hour. That was my experience. So this mother came, her son, first offense, burglary, and I called and told him to come in and pick him up. And so when he was released to her custody, we would have a little a conference before I would let them leave. And I told him, I said, young man, the only reason why you're in here is only because of your association with your friends who caused you to have been charged with burglary. It doesn't mean that you committed the burglary, young man, but it's just only because you were with the bad company. I said, and here your mother is working hard. She's telling me that you're making bad grades in school, and you now are beginning to associate with gang members. Young man, I'm releasing you this time. But if you ever come back in here again, I'm going to lock you up and I'm going to throw away the key. And so 2 weeks later, the mother called me. She said, Mr. Jackson, she said, I know you thought that the Lord was going to bless you to have a church to pastor. But Mr. Jackson, let me let you know that what you are doing is a ministry. And I can't thank you enough for your counsel to my son, because he's making all A's in school and he's no longer associating with gang members. That's my experience, Brother Earl.
And that is wonderful. And that is absolutely a wonderful story. That's a beautiful story. And, you know, the other side of that is often missed, that where young men, you know, don't understand it or they don't get the information, is that when you're incarcerated, you have experienced a trauma, and that trauma is going to stay with you. That emotional trauma. Sometimes it can stay with you, and you know, give you good behavior, and sometimes you got to repeat the course. But you know, when you have that trauma, there's usually another part of it, a history of different traumas that where you've numbed out to it, where you don't have a good inner compass that can guide you. There is this wonderful writer that's from California. Her name is Dr. Nadine Burke Harris, and she wrote a book called The Deepest Well. And she talks about how when you are stressed or for family pressures or economic pressures or societal pressures, that it impacts your body and your thinking on a cellular level. It even impacts, you know, how you learn and the information you take in. So you cannot learn if you're worried about, you know, somebody jumping on you or some sort of violence being committed against you.
Well, yeah.
So it becomes this chain. It becomes this spiral thing. And if you're unaware of it, it is so easy to get caught up and tangled up in that web. And then you have, as you say, a system out there that's waiting to lock you up and just, you know, put you away. But, you know, you know.
Right.
This is where mentoring and men and family and all of that comes in, where you get to say, hey, come here, let me talk to you for a minute. You know, not only the men, but the young ladies. You know, you know, just as you know, trying to, you know, help people understand. Even today, you know, when I teach in my class, and we talk about, you know, the current political environment, I tell my students, what is happening to this country right now, you may not think it's impacting you, but it is impacting you.
Right.
You have to get involved. You have to be able to argue. You have to be able to get a point across. You have to be able to influence. And, you know, that starts right here with learning how to argue a point. And at the same time, seeing someone else's point of view, but without losing your cool, you know, you have to stand strong. You have to know your mind. You have to have a strong, solid mind. Your mind is what they're trying to take, and you cannot give up your mind to foolishness and idiotic stuff and pop culture. Because that's what they want you to do. They want you to tune out. They don't
exactly.
want your mind to work. If your mind starts working and you start organizing and you start, you know, putting things together and you start understanding what's going on, well, no, they don't want that. Because
they don't,
just
no, they don't want that. But, what really is disappointing to me to this day, I noticed that there was one police agency that would bring numerous young black men to Los Padrinos Juvenile Hall, and that was known as that precinct police station was known as LAPD 77. And I noticed I got quite a few of those kids had been arrested by that agency. But I did not know the environment that they came out of, the community that they lived in, until my son had a yoga for youth yoga class there in this community that was called Jordan Downs, I think it was. Brother Earl, when I went with him, that community only had one way in, one way out, a liquor store on the corner. And when we parked in front of this school where my son was teaching his class, that school looked exactly like a detention center, Brother Earl. And when I looked around in the community there, naturally it was public assistance service it looked like a township community, and I thought I was in Africa somewhere, Brother Earl. And
you know,
do you know that the kids, I realized that they had no other opportunity really to associate with some youngsters that really could have improved their lives. Every corner almost was gangbangers. And here they grew up in this kind of community. And even when they had to go to the restroom, Brother Earl, they had to line up and be led to the restroom with the counselor as if they were in juvenile hall, Brother Earl. And I knew then that this was an incubator for all of those youngsters who grew up in that community. And LAPD was the agency that patrolled that community. And it still exists right now, Brother Carl. Nothing has changed.
Yeah, you know what? It's interesting from a historical standpoint. What you're describing sounds like convict leasing. I'm not sure if you've ever heard of the convict leasing system that took place at the turn of the 20th century. And after the great compromise,
what kind of system?
Convict leasing. Okay. So you know what convict leasing is? That they would make up trump up charges, people put them on chain gangs, put them in whatever.
Yeah.
You know, but they had people patrolling certain neighborhoods, and they would make up a trumped up charge where you did reckless eyeballing, so we're going to put you on 20 years, and we're going to get some free labor out of you.
We're going to patrol
this particular area because we know it's impoverished. We know there are no businesses here. We know there are no jobs here. We know that the school systems are failing. There's no libraries. There's nothing in there. So your choices are going to, you know, you're going to be living in desperation. And then we're going to pump in the stuff that's illegal and so that you can get caught up in it so that we can arrest you and lock you up legally. Okay? And then
pardon me for cutting you off. What surprised me was during the end of the yoga session that on that last day, me and my son stopped by Albertson's and we bought fried chicken. We stopped by Little Caesars and we bought five large pizzas. And we also brought to the school a variety of beverages. And do you know, at the end of the class, And those kids saw us bring this food in and the beverages. I mean, they had never had anyone really to treat them the way we did. And when my son said, okay, now it's time for us to eat and everything, they rushed over to the beverage bin. And I had to stop them. Wait a minute. Brother Earl, they had never, ever had that kind of experience before. And even the girls who took the yoga class from another yoga teacher, they voiced their selection. Now, we want to go over to where Mr. Jackson is teaching yoga because they're serving pizza and chicken and everything. And do you know what this female yoga teacher brought, you know, to congratulate them for a successful class? She brought licorice sticks. So you can understand why these girls didn't want licorice sticks when we provided these boys with the meal. And it's just ideas they had not. I said, no wonder they don't want these young people to associate outside of the boundaries in Watts here, because it isn't their fault in terms of the behavior that they would exemplify if they were allowed to visit a regular high school. These kids are being socialized to this kind of lifestyle on a daily basis. And I left there, Brother Earl, with a bitter taste in my mouth with regards to those youngsters' living conditions.
Hello?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right. Well, you know what? You know, Joseph, it has been, we have been talking for an hour, and that is our time, brother.
We just touched the surface.
I know we just touched the surface, but I want to take a moment to thank you for the conversation. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule. And thank you for sharing your knowledge and wisdom and your experiences. And thank you for the read-in at the Tougaloo Library. I mean, it is, you know, those were moments in your life that will live on. It's part of your legacy. It's part of the legacy of our experiences as Africans on the continent, on the North American continent. Again, I thank you for the fellowship. I thank you for taking the time to talk, and I appreciate you. Thank you so much.
Well, Brother Earl, thank you, because you have really motivated me beyond what I thought I could ever be motivated, as much as I am now from talking to you and knowing really, you know, that our lives are parallel. And that I can't do anything less but to continue my research regarding the Reconstruction period. And I am honored and I'm proud to have been chosen by Miss Beverly Black to have been introduced to such a great, brilliant young man as yourself. And thank you for really a great discussion about you.
Well, thank you so much, sir. And you have a wonderful evening. Much love.
Same to you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Are you willing? There's so many people in life who have so many dreams inside them, but they're not willing to do what it takes to achieve them. They'll sit around and they'll dream about them. And in their mind, sometimes they believe they've actually achieved something when in reality they've achieved nothing. Are you willing? Whatever that dream that you have within you, you have to be willing to sacrifice whatever it is that's going to distract you from doing it. You may have to give up hanging out with friends. You may have to give up going out to dinner. You will have to give up going out to parties because you have something inside you that you need to give birth to. Are you willing? Are you willing to do what it takes to give life to that dream that's inside of you? Most people are not, but that's what makes you different. Because you are willing to do what most people will not do. You are willing to put in the hours of work. You are willing to put in the blood, sweat, and tears. You're willing to go into it and learn as you go and make the mistakes and then correct yourself as you move toward this vision that you have. It's not going to be easy. Whenever you take on something new, whenever you take on a dream that you have, it's an uphill battle. There's no getting around it. It's going to be tough. There are going to be setbacks. There are going to be disappointments. There are going to be obstacles in your way that you could not have imagined. But that doesn't matter to you. Whatever comes your way, you are the type of person who is willing to deal with it, learn from it, and grow through the challenge. You're the one that gets pointed out in a crowd, and people say, that person is different. And that's a good thing.
crossroads and start feeling mixed signals like Morse code. My soul starts to grow colder than the North Pole. I try to focus on the hole of where the torch goes. In the tradition of these legendary sports pros, as far as I can see, I made it to the threshold. Lord knows I waited for this a lifetime, and I'm an icon when I let my light shine. Shine bright as an example of a champion, taking the advantage, never copping out or canceling. Burn like a chariot, learn how to carry it. Maverick, always above and beyond average. Fuel to the flame that I train with and travel with. Something in my eyes say I'm so close to having the prize. I realize I'm supposed to reach for the sky. Never let somebody try to tell you otherwise. One flame, one bonfire, let it burn higher. I never show signs of fatigue or turn tired, cause I'm the definition of tragedy turned triumph. It's David and Goliath, I made it to the eye of the storm, feeling torn like they fed me to the lions. Before my time starts to wind down like the Mayans, I show them how I got to grind down like a science. It sounds like a riot on hush, it's so quiet, the only thing I hear is my heart. I'm inspired by the challenge that I find myself standing eye to eye with, to move like a wise warrior and not a coward. You can't escape the history that you was meant to make. That's why the highest victory is what I'm meant to take. You came to celebrate, I came to celebrate. I hate losing, I refuse to make the same mistake.